Okay, so I think at this point I'm going to be calling this episode rescheduled. Technical difficulties. But it seems like everything is working on my end now. So probably the only thing that I had to do was an update, which, okay, it's kind of a weird thing to do to crash like that. But anyways, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Hopefully you enjoyed our previous interviews, and they're only going to ramp up as primary season comes to a head. We are, what, 10 days away from the 17th primary, which for those of you not counting the days, like myself, it gets very stressful. Very stressful. But I like to say that I have the privilege of interviewing our first gubernatorial candidate here. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So,
and I am counting the days, by the way.
Oh, I'm counting the days too. Trust me. I think once you get into politics, and this is like not even like you running as a candidate, just being exposed to it, you're like, okay, primary day, 10 days.
Yep, absolutely.
I can only imagine it's worse on your end, because you're like on at the highest raise of the state.
Yeah. And at some point, you know, you start working backwards from that date, right? You know, planning all of the different aspects of the campaign based on that deadline. And, you know, it can be quite the challenge on just a logistical perspective and, you know, getting all your whole team around that strategy of getting out the vote, you know, because our campaign, in Oregon, because we have the mail-in ballots, at some point your entire team just switches over to get out the vote type of activities.
Right. And for those of you unfamiliar with Oregon, how the way that Oregon conducts elections, it's all mail-in, which was a shocker for me coming from Texas, where we actually could go places and vote. But that is an issue nor here nor there. Ballots start being issued out April 26th. So when I say primary season is almost over, well, we've been in primary season since our whole campaigns are revolving around the 26th when ballots go out, and 17th is just kind of our last couple days before we actually get to find out who's moving to the general. So for those of you wondering, you may have gotten a ballot already. Make sure you vote. We're, like I said, 10 days away.
Yes.
So while we're talking on your campaign, how is your campaign going?
It's going well with a lot of candidates. I mean, we have, I think, 19 right now running in the primary for governor on the Republican side and several others on the Democrat side. So, you know, that poses its own challenges, but things are going well. We're getting out and meeting with a lot of people, and it's been an incredible experience.
So what have you learned while going out and campaigning? Because obviously, as a candidate for governor, you have to travel the state and talk with different people. What have you learned on the gubernatorial campaign trail? Because obviously, the governor's race is a lot different, and a lot larger than your previous run for the state senate.
Yeah, well, just like a lot of places, and this is true for Oregon, I think, is that because our state is so large geographically, parts of our state have their own unique culture, their own challenges. And there's a big issue around this urban-rural divide, and that's real. I see it in my area, so I'm from Medford. I see it down here. And when you go to the Portland metro area, much of the same challenges exist, but some of the reasons for them are a little bit different, and how people interpret those challenges are a little bit different. There are many, many Oregonians outside of that area that just feel ignored, and they're not shy about telling you all about it. So traveling the state is actually a really, really important part of this. And if you're going to be a governor in Oregon, it's really imperative to have that, that experience on the ground, really seeing what it's like to live in other parts of our state, because it is different.
So when you say that there's a big urban rural divide, what do you think, or what have they been telling you is the main reason why they feel ignored?
Well, I think it just some of it is just baked into the cake, right? We have our, we have a most of our population is in that Tri-County area, Portland metro area. And because of the way our, the districts are laid out, that's where the majority of legislators are from, right? So you have these, you know, the rest of Oregon has sort of light representation geographically, speaking, and the bulk of the representation really is representing that population based. And when that happens, there's a pretty big disconnect.
Right. And it's unfortunate that we are in a state where it only feels like the I-5 corridor is the one that has genuine representation.
Yeah. And, you know, there's laws that are being passed in Salem, and many policies that are put in place that maybe work for those areas. But when it gets rolled out to the rest of the state, people have to figure out how to work around them. And that's incredibly frustrating, and it's expensive for communities.
Absolutely. I could only imagine. I'm, for reference, I'm out here in Kaiser, so I'm not too far from Salem.
Mm-hmm.
So having to adjust from here wouldn't be as difficult to implement a policy as to somewhere in more rural Oregon.
Yeah.
Which, again, is unfortunate that that's the way that the state has allowed the system to be.
I mean, it's, again, you know, that's why it's important to have a mix of people at the table and to really listen to those voices. I feel like we've gotten a little bit away from that. We kind of go through the motions of that, right? But when it comes to actually hearing them and using that information to actually develop solutions, that part of that feedback loop is missing, right? So it's like, oh, you know, we'll get people together. We'll hear what their challenges are. We'll take into consideration their ideas, but we're really just going to do what we want to do anyway. And that's been the sort of mode of operation now for quite some time. And people are over it. They're frustrated. And I totally get it. I mean, we saw some of the, 6 hours worth of testimony on making the masks mandatory. Remember, that was not that long ago, a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. And, you know, they heard that testimony and did what they wanted to do anyway. And that was part of what happened at the OHA. And it was, I actually asked about that. So I happen to sit on the Oregon Health Policy Board, which you would think would have access and sort of be involved in helping to set those policies, but it's actually not what that policy board does at all. None of that information even came before us. We never even had the opportunity to have a discussion. So it was even for those boards and committees, there's limited, I think, ability to have a voice and to have influence over some of those policy decisions.
Right. And as you were saying, it's hard to kind of exercise the ability to oversee bureaucracies when the bureaucracies don't allow you to do that.
Yeah.
They'll just go over your head.
Exactly. It's sort of self-fulfilling, right?
Especially with the voters, you know, the whole thing is they have to come up with a rule, then they have to have this public hearing, then they have to vote on it. And it feels like the first two parts of this process was more done out of saying that it just had to be done because they already knew what they wanted to do.
Yeah. And that's a shame because it's not the way that system was supposed to work. It's really, we're supposed to take into consideration the voice of the people. We're supposed to really do the work and make sure that we are hearing them, we're incorporating those ideas, and that they actually do have a voice. And we've gotten to the point under one party rule, right, that those are just sort of, it's sort of an afterthought, right? It's, yes, we go through the mechanics of the actual process, but we're really, the decision's already made. And you know, in some cases that may not be true, but that's the perception. And that's how people feel, especially outside that Portland metro area in our rural areas. I mean, that's a real thing. And we saw it take place when they made the decision to shut down the summer hatchery program for Steelhead on the Umpqua, right? There was many testimonies. The tribes came out against shutting down that program. And yet the decision was made to shut it down anyway, despite, you know, the solutions that were put forth and the testimony against it. So, you know, I think we've got that's a good part of, I think, why we need new leadership. We have to have a different perspective, a different style of leadership. I'm a CEO in my own company. I think Oregon can really benefit from the leadership, that kind of leadership, where we're really looking at operational streamlining and making sure that not only are we making good decisions and that we're really hearing people, but that our state is capable of executing the basic functions that we're required to do. I mean, you think about what happened with COVID and the inability for us to even get out unemployment checks. I mean, that's a basic government function, and it was a real struggle for us.
Yeah, I've heard many horror stories about waiting for those COVID relief checks that just never seem to have arrived. And when you have a bureaucracy that no longer functions the way that it was supposed to do, you know, many of us wonder, well, why is that bureaucracy still there?
Right. Yeah. I mean, we need to do some work on it for sure. We're not really a functional state.
Right. If it's and if the argument is made that it's not the system, it's who's in charge of the system. Why do we continue to let people who we know for a fact will not make a system work are still in charge of that system?
Yeah.
It feels like it's either way you put it, it reflects poorly on the state's leadership.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I absolutely. And I think, you know, that people are tired of it and it's going to change. I really feel like there's enough momentum. There's enough frustration that if we have the right candidate, we're going to see some big changes during this next election cycle.
That's the hope, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. Absolutely.
So that's a really good start of talking about policy. Now, I was going through your website and I have a couple of things I want to ask you about your policy.
Sure.
Policies. So maybe we can spend more time, because I've read your interviews and I've seen I've seen the different interviews. By the way, I've really enjoyed them. You are one of the few candidates that seem like a well of knowledge.
Thank you.
On topics. So yeah. Hopefully this discussion will be fruitful.
Yeah, I hope so.
The number one topic on voters' minds going into the primary season, homelessness. Now, yeah. Interviewers and yourself have talked about your experience on the street as a teen and how that really shaped you. And you can tell that story better than I can. It's on your website. But I wanted to ask you, which I don't think anybody has asked you, is, what made you decide that your policy response would be modeled similar to elderly care?
Yes. So when you look at just the infrastructure that we have for homelessness, and especially when we talk about unsheltered homelessness, you know, there's this big movement towards we need more shelters, we need more beds. But what happens is you now have... you have these temporary shelters. People go, they check in for a night. You can't stay there during the day. There's really not, we don't do well at all with wraparound services. And so it's just, we're just sort of offering temporary relief. Whereas really what we need is to make this a truly community based solution and have it be effective. Rather than just providing these sort of temporary places for people to go and get out of the elements. And, you know, if you look at the root cause of what we see in the unsheltered homeless today, and it's different than, you know, what it was 25 years ago. But what we see today is that it's really being driven by addiction and mental health. And in many cases, both. So if you talk to experts, they'll tell you, yeah, 85% of people that are unsheltered are struggling with drugs, alcohol, and then potentially, in addition to that, some sort of mental health condition that they've been battling. And when you deal with that, you're talking about you need long-term solutions. You need support that lasts, you know, more than a couple of days, more than a month, more than even 2 months in some cases, right? And that's where I think we can really excel as a state. We're spending the money anyway. We've spent, you know, millions and millions of dollars just doing basic outreach. You're talking about, you know, putting houses and hotels and all of this, all of these resources, but they're not connected in a really meaningful way. Right. And so the easiest sort of model that I could think of that was similar and the easiest to communicate was our elderly care model. And it's very well organized and it's designed to help people at different stages of their condition, whatever that might be. And so in that model, if you adapt it towards supporting and helping people get healthy that are struggling addiction, mental health, and are unsheltered, you really got to start with that most secure level of care, right? And we can leverage our court system and our law enforcement system to help us get people into these long-term rehabilitation programs when they wouldn't otherwise volunteer to do it, right? Because if you are being driven by an addiction and you're struggling with mental health, those people are going to tell you, no, I'm not going there. Hell no. I don't need help. I'm perfectly fine, right? You're the problem. And so they're not healthy enough to really start making the decisions for themselves. And they're carrying out property crimes and all these other things. And it's really making some of our communities really, it's just such a struggle with the garbage and the blight that creates. And so I think if we can help people get healthy and get them into these programs, stabilize them, and then they can start making those decisions for themselves, we're going to have a really great model for success long term.
Right. So let's talk about that. So we're going to, for your policy, we mm-hmm. would obviously sink the money and resources necessary. So just for context, the state of Oregon paid out $575 million for long-term elderly care. Mm-hmm. And in 2017, that jumped up 26% to $730 million. Now, I know that the state has the money, mm-hmm. has the money for homelessness if we're spending it on other ridiculous programs that we really don't need.
Right.
So my question to you, I guess, seeing as how this is going to be like you said, something that isn't going to be resolved in 5 years, in 10 mm-hmm. years even. It's a long-term strategy. What programs do you see the state needing to cut back in order to combat the root cause rather than trim around the bush and hoping the bush doesn't grow back?
Yeah, I think every person that's living unsheltered on the street is, we're paying, you know, $35,000 per person right now, just in the dealing with the auxiliary issues that come with that, right? Cleaning up those streets, dealing with the situation where you've got police officers that are interfacing with this population of people over and over again and not getting anywhere. We're seeing people cycle through our jails and also acute care in the hospitals. So there's a collective cost to that. And so when you start to actually solve the problem, that will allow you to direct funds where they really need to be. So it's not about cutting programs that are effective. It's about making sure that we're using our dollars strategically so that we can actually make long-term improvements. Because right now we're putting a lot of money towards these issues and the problem continues to get worse, which is really, really expensive. Not only that, it's costing Oregonians, you know, they're paying now increased insurance and, you know, these other things that are seemingly maybe unrelated, but really are related. And so it's how do we make good investments on actually solving the problem, not enabling the problem. And I think ultimately we're going to save money on this and we're going to have a better quality of life.
Right. And I guess while we're on the topic of enabling, mm-hmm. the state of Oregon has done nothing but enable people who should be getting help we've been enabling them to not seek help, in fact. I'm almost curious to think, I almost assume that you would agree with me when I say that the state of Oregon has done nothing but foster this almost atmosphere of acceptance, not for the mental health aspect of it, but for those who are addicted to drugs.
Yeah.
And we've seen this when the district attorney put on a misleading title for a ballot measure, passed it overwhelmingly. So my question to you is, as governor, would you support legislators and or citizen-led initiatives to repeal in part or all of Measure 110?
I think it would certainly be helpful. We saw a huge uptick in addiction-related deaths, right? Overdoses. Now we have all of our police officer carrying Narcan, right? So that if they come across somebody who's taken fentanyl or whatever these drugs are, they've got a chance at saving that person. So it's, you know, you've now got harm reduction. That is, that's a buzzword for just making sure that you're not you're giving people the tools so that when they are using, they're not actually killing themselves. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's not solving the problem. That is the opposite of what compassion really is. And what someone really needs to do, and this is the job of leadership in our state, they need to say, look, we care so deeply about you that we are not going to let you destroy yourself like that. You wouldn't let that happen to your sister, your brother, your cousin, or at least we try like hell not to whenever that is an issue in a family. And I've talked to many, many families that are struggling with similar issues, and they feel really helpless because we don't have the resources to actually provide those families with the right type of support. And because we don't have the resources, our court system is unwilling to take action. So you might have somebody that, you know, really should be committed to some sort of program, right? But the courts won't do it, right? And until they're either tried to hurt themselves or hurt someone else. And by that time, it's almost too late. You've already seen the worst of the problem in many cases. And so we have to be much more proactive about really solving those problems and not being an enabler. And it's, you know, I look at this and sort of the enabling part, I think, is started out as just sort of a misguided attempt at being compassionate. And now it's become almost more of an industry, right? Which is a very healthy dynamic for a state to have. And it's all up and down the West Coast. And, you know, Oregon has this really incredible opportunity to solve this problem with the right strategy and the right leadership.
And I think it begins as when Oregon has a legislature and a Senate that are Republican, because people often mistake the fact that because Oregon is a blue state, that the Democrats have a majority in both chambers, when in reality, their majority is razor thin in both chambers.
Well, certainly a split Senate and a split House would be an incredible benefit to all Oregonians. And if we had that, we would be required to have that conversation and actually develop solutions that are balanced.
Right. And it begins with us having that discussion with the other side about the harm of ballot measure 110. And if gridlock continues to occur, I say, you know, we leave it to the people. You know, they're the ones that have been dealing with it, and let these legislatures who are dead set on this kind of mindset don't necessarily see it. And I believe that that's a huge disconnect in some aspects of our legislature, and this is one of those issues.
Yeah, I mean, well, the way that they sold, Measure 110 to people was that we shouldn't be throwing people in jail for addiction, right? And I agree, but the problem is we don't have any place for them to go. So not only can we not use our court system now they're just allowed to become more and more severe, and the problem continues to get worse as we are not properly funding law enforcement, making sure that we're working on retention for officers, making sure that they have the right tools to actually work with people in that population, and that they have the proper training. And you know, so you add all of these things up and it actually makes our problem worse, not better.
Right. But that is exactly where it begins. Come general election 2022, yep. Going forward, we need to have that discussion.
We actually have to get off our asses and start doing something about it.
Absolutely. But it starts, it starts with the offering of the olive branch to the other side. And a lot of these Democrats will look at, and I've seen this before. I've talked to many of my Democratic colleagues. They've mm-hmm. seen what the new Democratic Party has become. And they kind of find themselves, you know, in the middle, not totally Democrat, but not totally Republican. And that, I think, in the legislature is exactly where we can start getting these allies to get away from Democrats who subscribe to the Portland ideology or the Eugene ideology. But we should start there. And I guess while we're on the topic of drug addiction and mental health, I had a question. That I don't think a lot of people ask a lot, and I think I understand why.
Yeah.
But as governor, would you support policy that would increase and improve the efficiency of the programs that we have in the state hospital?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need policies that help to hold people accountable. So it's not necessarily how many people did you serve. I want to know what the outcome was. How effective are we actually being as a state? How do we measure these programs? And I think what we don't see is, and what we don't have access to in many cases, is longitudinal data. This is data that follows the person over time. So if a person has accesses like, you know, 3 out of 10 available public programs to them, are they actually improving? Do they have more opportunity? Are they actually getting the training or the work experience that they need in order to be successful? Or are they just going through the motions to get access to those safety net dollars, right? And I think that's a really important thing to measure. And right now, it's very, very difficult. We don't share data across different agencies. There's a lot of bureaucracy that's in the way. And it's very difficult to tell why programs are not as effective as they should be. And we've got to be able to dig into that. And that takes right people leading those agencies that are collaborative, that are willing to think outside the box and willing to adapt models that are working in other states.
Right. And as we start to wind down here, I have a question here for you from the education part of your website. So in the education part of your website, you say that Oregonians who have to take remedial courses at an Oregon college should have those remedial classes provided to them by the college, or at least by the state. And I wanted to ask you, what made you come up with this?
Well, look, if we've got a kid that goes through high school and is allowed to graduate, let's say they go 3 out of the 4 years, and they're graduating and they're not making the basic sort of threshold for community college, I'm sorry, that's a failure of that system. And we should hold that system accountable. And it's, you know, you look at graduation rates, you look at preparedness. There's a lot that we can do to help our kids be globally competitive. And I think, you know, I'm talking basic division, multiplication, basic math that kids are graduating and they're really not capable of doing. That's why they're forced to take remedial classes in college. And now we have the Higher Education Coordinating Commission communicating to our public university system that, you know, now it falls on the universities to provide that extra support. Which is expensive. So it's not even that the universities are saying, no, we don't want to do it. Of course we want to do it. The problem is that it's more expensive for those students, since now they're paying for a course so that they can actually move on and actually start working on their degree. They're not even getting credit for those courses. And it delays their ability to get that degree by, as long as possibly 2 years, depending on how many classes they need to get to be get caught up. Mm-hmm. And so we're, instead of actually fixing the K-12 system, we're just pushing we're kicking the can down the road and expecting that situation to be corrected in now adults. And it's really contributing, I think, to people's inability to be competitive, especially in the job market.
Right. Thank you for that. I was genuinely curious as well, and I haven't heard anybody ask you that.
Yeah.
So I take pride in being very unique in an interview.
Thank you. It's a great question.
While we're on the topic of education, you specifically mentioned on your website that Measure 97, which allowed for youth apprenticeships in the state of Oregon. And I wanted to ask you, how do you envision that within your administration? What is your end goal with this?
Yeah, so youth apprenticeships are an amazing tool. They've been using this in Europe for quite a long time. It's called the Swiss model, and it's actually started in Germany quite some time ago. And what they do is they align classes to that student's area of interest, and in the 11th grade they actually start working, and the work that they're doing, it actually is they're earning high school credit for that work. And so then their classes are aligned, and they actually go senior year, they start working a little bit more. And the hope is that when they graduate, they've got a clear career path and they have work experience and real world skills. And in addition to that, it keeps them engaged in school. Whereas, if you're 16, 17, you're struggling at home, you come from, let's say, a lower income family that is barely able to afford the basics books, you're sort of your prospects of graduating from, an Ivy League school is like nil. That can be really demotivating. And the best way we can keep those students engaged is showing them a path to prosperity and helping them to develop those skills. And it's highly, highly effective. I mean, they're doing this in Wisconsin and North Carolina. They have over half of all of the youth apprentices in the United States. Is in those two states, and their workforce system is doing really well. They're also developing this in Colorado. And it used to be where we look at apprenticeships as just primarily trades, electrical, automotive, those types of career paths. But this can be for engineering, it could be for architecture, it can be for the medical field, banking. We now have the ability to be very creative and engaging with these programs.
Thank you for that. Again, just very genuinely curious. I don't get a lot of candidates to talk about that. So like I said, you are a well of knowledge
when it comes to the
topics. And I appreciate them. I appreciate the in-depth answer.
Yeah.
One last thing here before we end things off here. While we're looking at the May 17th primary, why do you believe that you are the one who could not only take the primary, but will defeat Tina Kotek in the primary? I mean, in the general.
Yeah, I think at this point, Tina Kotek will be a formidable candidate, but I think, as a general, in the general election, we see the results of that kind of leadership. She's been in leadership for quite some time. And so there's a lot to point to where we need change. I think that what makes me unique is I think I have the best policies out of all of the candidates. I've spent a lot of time looking through these policies over the years and developing them. I've served on a lot of boards and commissions and worked actively on putting these policy concepts together. So they're really well developed and ready to execute. I've got the business background and the leadership skills to do well. My company, we make microchips. And if you look at a lot of the job opportunities in Oregon is tied to the semiconductor industry. And so my company is part of that industry. It's You know, semiconductors are responsible for $11 billion in exports and over 43,000 jobs in our states. And we have not done the work of really nurturing that industry or the auxiliary industries that helps to support it. And I'm talking about everything from people doing construction in that industry to you know, the machine shops that support those that industry and a lot of other you know, really great paying jobs in our state. And we have an opportunity in Oregon to recapture some of that manufacturing as it's coming back to the US. And I don't see any of our other candidates really talking about this. They're very concerned about social issues. And yes, those are important, but we've got a, we've got an opportunity here to be at the forefront of that movement and help to onshore those jobs and capture that part of the economy, use our public university system to really help implement our economic development strategy. And that's going to positively impact rural Oregon as well as our urban centers and will set us up for a really prosperous future.
Well, Jessica, I appreciate the conversation. I'm always happy to sit down and talk policy once you've gone through the primary. And I know it's going to be a lot harder to contact you as governor, but
you know, I'll be around.
The hope is that I can still get with you and talk policy.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Well, again, thank you for getting back to me on this. Ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't voted yet, you have a candidate right here. And all I'm saying is you've heard everything. And I believe that Jessica is one of the candidates with the more substantive issues at hand here. Though I don't really, though social issues are important, as you said, you have to get, when fixing the state or fixing bad leadership, you got to get to the root of the problem. Yeah. And I believe that you are the one to do that. So
thank you so much.
I'm rooting for you.
Yes.
Good luck on your primary race. And we'll definitely get back right after the primary.
Excellent. Thanks for having me on. Right. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on.